We'll call the meeting together to order at this time, and we're starting with the smaller budget, not less important, smaller budget presentations. And we do have budget books for the members of the committee. We just don't happen to have them for this meeting, but you will have them by the next meeting. So take notes that you'll diligently add to your budget book when you get it. So we're starting with the agency overview and budget presentation from the Department of Military Affairs. Department of Military Affairs. And General Sarita.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Major General Larry Shalito. I am the Adjutant General for the State of Minnesota. With me is Colonel Eric Allness. He is my Special Assistant in Legislative Matters, both federal and state. And in the audience, we have Mr. Terry Palmer, who is the number cruncher, and he will be giving a lot of the budget information and so forth as we deal with it. And next to him is Brigadier General Tim Casalter, who is my Assistant Adjutant General for the Air, which includes both the 133rd out of Minneapolis and the 148th out of Duluth. Rather than using the PowerPoint presentations, we just printed them out, and you should have in front of you a handout that pictorially shows what I'm going to be talking about. And then also you should have a copy of our annual report. One of the items in the job description of Adjutant General is to report to the governor and to the legislature the activities of the Minnesota National Guard for the previous fiscal year. And we have chosen the federal fiscal year of October 1st through the end of September. And as you look at that, and as you obviously know, we've been extremely busy in the last 3-4 years since 9/11/01. If you take a look at the first page, beyond our cover page, I do want to focus on the cover page for a second. On the top, you will see to the right side, the First Minnesota Charging, the famous historical print of the First Minnesota at Gettysburg. And then you'll see also the Red Bull patch in the midst of fighting in Iraq. And we have just celebrated our 150th anniversary as a Minnesota National Guard, going back to the Pioneer Guard that started in 1856. And what's going to be interesting is there's going to be a number of things that will be going through the legislature, but this is going to be a dynamic series of 3 to 4 years. We had the 150th anniversary of the National Guard. Next year will be the 150th anniversary of the statehood. And a couple years later will be the 150th anniversary of Minnesota being the first state to step forward in support of keeping the Union together at a dinner with Governor Ramsey, back then with President Lincoln, saying Minnesota would volunteer. So it's a historic period of time for the state of Minnesota. The second slide is what probably will oftentimes be a common question that you will experience. Why are we taking care of the Guard and we don't take care of the active duty and we don't take care of the Army Reserve or Air Reserve? As you look at this, and for those that know this, I apologize, but the all active and reserve are taken oath to the Constitution of the United States. They work solely for the President and the U.S. government. For simplistic terms, they are federal employees. What we have to the right is the National Guard that gives allegiance both to the Constitution of the United States, but also to the Constitution of the state of Minnesota. And the Commander-in-Chief of the Minnesota National Guard during peacetime is the Governor of the state of Minnesota. Therefore, we are the only ones that can be called out to support firefights, floods, tornado relief, so forth. I just mentioned this, and I can apologize for those that know this, but this is going to be a national debate because last year there was language that would give the President more authority to have posse comitatus ruling and authority in the case of an insurrection or insurgency. And this is a knee-jerk reaction to some of the issues related to Katrina. So you may hear about that, but right now it looks like that will be what was passed last year will be withdrawn, and we'll get back to more stable conditions. And on the next page, the third slide, you will see the numbers, if you will, of the Minnesota National Guard. Minnesota National Guard, Army and Air, basically leads the nation in strength and in, I'm going to say, in objectively in strength and readiness and performance, but also subjectively in the area of reputation and esprit. The Army National Guard, currently we're authorized a little over 9,500. We have 10,463 in boots. Now you might say, how can we afford that overage? That's because many other states in the nation are under strength. So we have been given a overall, we've been given authority to continue to recruit and continue to build. And now that we're going through series of transformation, we have the national government looking to Minnesota for even future units and equipment and authorization. We're debating that and looking at that very carefully because we will not accept anything that does not have a good fit for the state of Minnesota. The Air Guard makes up two units, and they've been in the news recently. The 133rd, you remember in December and January, where we had deployment ceremonies, and they're off to Afghanistan. They're in Afghanistan as we speak. The 148th, we had a formal ceremony on Sunday in Duluth, and they are going to Iraq. I will tell you right now that they have been engaged in combat with those F-16s as we speak. They have already done it. And then we have a Joint Force Headquarters, which is the blending of Army and Air just to coordinate and synchronize our resources. So we have a total of 13,000. I'll go through these next slides rather quickly. In the Army side, it's a breakdown. We have the division, which includes the 1st Brigade Combat Team. Those are that 2,600 troops that are currently in Iraq. They represent virtually every seemingly region in Iraq, except probably the northern deal with the Kurds. When you hear about Fallujah, you're hearing about Minnesota. When you hear about Anbar, you're hearing about Minnesota. When you hear about Baghdad, you're hearing about Minnesota. We are pretty much all over. The most significant thing that has occurred that you are aware of is that they were due home in March, and they have now been extended to probably the 1st of August, an extra 125 days. And that's because of the president's surge. The troops, everyone, bottom line, was disappointed. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. The troops stoically said, all right, we'll deal with it. We'll move on. That's what we volunteered for. The families went through the whole series of emotions, and now we've met with them. And while they don't like it, they understand, and they're getting on with business because they do know they're coming back home. I still find probably, and this is I couldn't prove it statistically, but people who are not directly involved seem to be the most upset or can't let it go. But we're moving on, and we're taking care of the families, and we're taking care of the soldiers, and we are preparing for their return. We just met this morning with the governor's cabinet and talking about ways, and we'll be meeting on a regular basis just to make sure that because they come back on the 1st of August, how do I get about 25% of those returning soldiers into the Minnesota educational system as quickly as possible? And we are working back in to make sure that we don't have some kind of bureaucratic, you can't do this, or bureaucratic, you can't do that. Last year's session, I handled a lot of those. Representative Kahn, the deal with when they're deployed, remember the add-on, 2 years plus, that's eased a lot of minds of troops overseas. Our troop command is growing. We have a regional support command. What I will just give you a heads up on that regional support command, because of the political pressure on the length of deployments of troops, you probably heard in the news that the Office of Secretary of Defense Gates said that there will be a deployment no longer than 12 months. That's a double-edged sword. Everyone loves that and embraces that. But now what happens is I become the signatory on making sure that they have been properly trained and validated to go to war. So as you will see in the next year, year and a half, as we build up our regional training center, we'll be taking those warriors that have come back from combat, and they will be part of our faculty, if you will, making sure that they are getting as the most current and best training possible. We are working with the federal government as we speak. We have one of my generals, General Trost, in Atlanta as we speak, talking about these issues. So, yes, it's great to have a short term, but we're not going to put someone and send them off and say, you're ready. We will validate that they are properly trained. Just to give you, in the military, we use the term op-tempo. On the Air Guard, the 133rd with its 1,242 airmen have served since 9/11 in 28 regions across the world. The 148th Fighter Wing with its 1,000 plus, getting new equipment, they have capped Minneapolis-St. Paul, they have capped Washington, D.C., and they're going to be capping us again, I'm sure, when we have the Republican National Convention. But they are now currently being deployed to Iraq. And again, they have been in 12 different zones or regions since 9/11. We have our federal mission, which I just described. We also have our state missions. And again, as you see in this, the numbers that you see, like the 3,140, is what we refer to as man days. If we pay one person one day's salary, that's one man day. So you could divide that. So if we had 100 people on, that would have meant in 03 that they served 31.4 days each. So it works out that way. We are designed to be in there quickly. We are designed to support law enforcement and other agencies. We are designed to give them some extra relief, if you will. What we need to be aware of now is that as we prepare for this spring, we just flew into Duluth. The ground is brown. You know, this is the most snow we've seen in a long time. We don't know, but we don't anticipate a large amount of flood fighting this spring, which means that there will be a large number of grass fires. And just for your information, statistically, the first time the National Guard will be off, called out this year will be on April 15th for a grass fire. One year it was the 13th, another year it was the
14th. You bet your budget on that?
Well, actually,
you put double or nothing on your budget?
No. Madam Chair, the point I want to make out is we have been keeping historical records and so forth, okay, because we want to make sure, we owe to the state of Minnesota to be prepared to handle any event. And it's kind of interesting because in dealing with the federal, we knew that there's a high potential for boundary water fire. And while we don't support the federal government unless asked, they won't let us support them unless we're properly trained. So a year ago, February, we sent them off to training. They did all the training. They were validated. We were ready to support them during a boundary water fire. And some individuals said, no, this T wasn't crossed and this I wasn't dotted, so we can only send one bird instead of both birds. But we worked it out, and that's our job. Okay. I'd like you to turn to the page that shows the community's impact. The current deployment has over, right now, I'll say over 585 communities impacted. There's only 960-some that have city water, you know, so that's if that was a classification you'd use. I will just say anecdotally, I spoke before I came here to the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutual Insurance companies, about 500 plus at a luncheon. I asked them how many know personally someone who is currently or has been deployed in either Afghanistan or Iraq. I would say 90 plus percent of that room stood up. And they are the small town insurance provider and the farm communities and so forth. So the entire state of Minnesota is impacted, not only the 585 communities that are currently over there, but also 85 of the 87 counties. And I think with the Air Guard now being deployed, I think we got 87 out of 87. Now, the thing that we're most concerned about and the thing the soldiers ask us most seriously about is we say, what can we do for you? And they say, without exception, take care of my family. Just take care of my family. So we spent close to $1 million through some federal assistance to establish 11 family assistance centers across, strategically located across the state, normally in areas that are known as major unit headquarters. They are staffed with full-time personnel. They are trained in a lot of the key issues. And then with them, they satellite out in little star clusters or satellites around those centers. We have what we call family readiness groups. And these are volunteers who agree to keep in contact and have their families or their units actively involved in some of the activities. This became most imperative, apparent when President of the United States said that we are going to extend the troops. We were authorized at 9 o'clock to release that information. At 9:01, I pushed a button that went out to an email that went to all the family assistance centers, all the family readiness groups. They in turn got it, and they have their automatic email tree, and they pushed it out. That's why you're saying that they were upset, because they heard it first either in the media, because they didn't check their email, but they did not hear it first from the troops themselves. We have been participating in and asked to testify before via teleconference the Office of Secretary of Defense's panel on defining out how we can better notify people. And it was just I don't know how you can make it better. But the number one thing that we've told them is the proper way it should be is the troops hear it first. They get an opportunity, a window of time to hear it or to tell their families before it gets out to the media. Unfortunately, some person felt it important to give it to New York Times and CNN and the AP before it was announced. And why do I know that? Because the official document for the news release was worded verbatim prior to it being released. So that's a gosh-shucks. As we move on, just a little plus, if you will, Minnesota prides itself on being outstanding in the National Guard and so forth, but we're also extremely proud of our working with the environment and all the agencies that relate to it. And last year, we were not allowed to compete with it because we won it 5 years earlier, and you can't compete for it for another 5 years, and we competed for it again last year, and we won. And Minnesota, and Camp Ripley in particular, was awarded the State of the Year Environmental Programs by the National Guard. And this is worldwide, not just statewide. So we're extremely proud of that and the team. And we have the largest population of wolves. And we're growing fast. With the turkeys are having a great winter. Unfortunately, the deer population, which is already overpopulated, is having a great year also. The black bear, they're going to be out. They're in the den. So we're very, very proud of that. And Madam Chair, we invite this committee to Camp Ripley. We will, give you all the information that you would possibly need. And we're not authorized to wine and dine, but we would love to just be able to show off an asset that is really. I'm tired of the old comment of. Oh, yeah, I always wondered, because I always drove by it on the way to Gull Lake, so I'll just leave it at that. Now, as I introduced earlier,
Hunts there?
Pardon?
You have hunts there?
Hunts?
Get rid of hunts to get rid of the geopopulation.
One of the things that we've worked very popular with the Department of Natural Resources, and one of the things the legislature did last year was allow us to have special hunts for the returning veterans. And we've had special hunts for deer with disabled vets. We've had turkey hunts and so forth. And I will just tell you, I got a Christmas card from Mrs. Stanfus. Adam Stanfus was a young troop out of Marshall area that lost his left arm over in Iraq about two or three years ago, going through some tough times. And now I got the Christmas card. He is married. He is doing very, very well. It's going so forth, but he's now very popular because all his brothers and relatives want to go with him because he gets to go to the deer hunt and the turkey hunt at Camp Ripley. So I appreciate the legislature for doing that. Mr. Palmer and Colonel Aldis are my subject matter experts. They are tasked and missioned to make sure that they are on top of all the activities that relate to the state and the federal legislative actions. And what we have done, and I just offer to all of you, should you get an inquiry from any of your constituents, that you route it through us, and we will do the investigation on it, and we will get back to you in a prompt manner so that you can at least say, one, you can say very immediately, it's been referred to, and they have promised me this, to get back to you, so you've got that, but also we do the answers. Probably the most difficult thing that you need to understand is people that are overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth are under federal authority. And once they are given that Title X status, we as a state lose all control over them. But they're very polite because when they come back, we get them back. So we do it that way. So at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Colonel Alness to talk about the legislative initiatives. And I'm going to ask Mr. Palmer if he'd please come forward.
Okay, I'll take this moment to have, we have a quorum now, and so we have the minutes are before us, and Representative Winkler moved adoption of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes. We also want to point out, I don't remember if we did this on the first day, but I'll point out that we have Mr. Cleary from House Research who joins us at the table for the, whenever we deal with military affairs. And he's a super absolute expert if you ever need anything done. And beyond being wonderful at doing it, he then years later remembers every step of what we did if you ever need to go back and find that out, too. So don't have... and let me also take this opportunity. Sorry I've gone so late without doing it. We now have our real pages, our permanent pages, and I'd like to... both stand up and introduce themselves. Made it easy to have the same name, but so one is Andy and one is Andrew, but they'll answer to either. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. General, before you get off, and Colonel, Camp Fort Ripley is in my district, as you well know, Colonel and General, and I've had the pleasure of seeing the environmental program there and seeing the camp and having toured the camp. My son was a large person, as you're well aware of. And I just want to talk about, as you've mentioned, General, when a constituent calls us with concern on the deployment of their loved ones, I have been in close touch with Colonel on several of those occasions, and I want you to know that the Colonel and the General have both immediately responded and heartfeltly responded to the constituents, and even on the weekends. I was even walking home the other night from here, General, and in the middle of I-94, this car pulls up next to me, and out gets this gentleman in uniform, and I didn't recognize him at first. I thought I was being attacked or something, but but it was General. It was General Shelter that came to me with a... and I really appreciate that. So when they say that they immediately get back to you, to us, to our constituents, and there's heartfelt, so much appreciate that. So much appreciate that.
Thank you. Chris, I'm sorry, I don't know, General, if you need to come back up, or we'll see. Well, let's see. Chris, do you have something?
Madam Chair, I just had two brief questions that I've had trouble keeping up to date regarding deployments, particularly to Iraq or Afghanistan. What is the current Department of Defense guidance or the regulations regarding how often a guard or reserve soldier can be deployed within a particular period of time? I mean, take your hypothetical PFC or specialist. How often can they be deployed within a year or two-year period? What's the current guideline?
Madam Chair, Representative DeForest, that's a good question. And I'm not being facetious. There's been something, if they've been over the 735 days, two-year mark. For example, we had a large number of constituents that may be yours that were in Bosnia or Kosovo, then they got to Iraq. They had to sign a release saying they volunteered to continue on. And if they went over the 2 years in a combat zone, they were then eligible for a hazardous or incentive pay, Army incentive pay program. And that's kind of what's been happening. For example, of the 2,600 from Minnesota that are currently in Iraq, over 800 of them signed a voluntary statement to go over there. And so now what's happened, though, is the President of the United States said, I am extending you. I have that authority, which he does, and they are extended. So I got a call from a lady from Florida whose son was getting on a plane in Kuwait who was pulled off because he wore the Red Bull patch. He's not going home. He's an IRR. He served on active, was off, was called back. You would think he would be an exception. No one is an exception. And then we got a call, and I'm going to be speaking to the Blue Star Mothers tonight, the Blue Star Mother from Coon Rapids who went out to New York to find out, to greet her son as he came back from Afghanistan, and he was extended. What's happening right now is they have a dream sheet, and you hear about this 1 in 5, 1 in 4, 1 in 6, 1 year on duty and 5 years to well or at home. And they're dreaming about this one in about every 5 years you can anticipate. If nothing's happening, like the Cold War, you know, you go through that phase and you go to the bottom line again and you continue. But it's managing resources and operation tempo. So when you get into that year 4 and 5, when you get in the window to be deployed, you get more training dollars, etc. However, what they're finding right now is, I would say the current dwell time is 3 years. And without getting into the specifics, which I can't, you're going to start getting letters of people that are a little irritated. And what's happening though, it's the legal right of the Department of Defense to request this.
And Madam Chair, in general, just a follow-up, I have friends with whom I served who are now officers in the Guard or Reserve component, and they were starting to run into situations now with second and third deployments to Iraq, for example, where they were finding a number of their soldiers were butting up against these deployment limits. So what they were doing is compromising unit integrity and unit cohesion by picking people. You know, this soldier hasn't gone over the limits, but his three squad mates have, so we'll pluck him and put him in another unit and sending, doing precisely what you know we found to be wrong about Vietnam, deploying soldiers as opposed to units. I was just curious,
yes.
Do you see this problem with the Minnesota Guard? If so, do you,
Madam Chair,
is it a problem?
Representative Forrest, I'll answer that question directly. Yes, it is. It is a problem. The 168 troops I mentioned, the young ones, is a collection of young people recruited since their unit deployed over to Bosnia and now Iraq. They represent three different battalions. They come in. They're all basic right out of AIT or advanced training. They are young. That is correct. I will tell you, however, because of this current recent surge and so forth, and the National Adjutant General Association of the United States, we have said, all right, first of all, you have misused us so much. For example, the 1st Brigade Combat Team currently in Iraq is the Minnesota Brigade, and it's the only combat brigade in the National Guard over in Iraq. Okay? Well, that's not bad. You got all these, you know, 30-some brigades in the Guard, and you only got one of them over there? What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is we have at any given time since the start of the war anywhere between 45 to 60 security companies over there that are not on anyone's radar screen. That 168, they are supporting a unit over there. They don't get to raise the flag to say it's Minnesota. We have a potential deployment coming up, and we're getting to that scenario too, where we can furnish two of the three elements. We believe in unit integrity, which I know you do. And so we are, as we speak, General Cross is telling the 1st Army Commander that we will not start piecemealing other units because it's, you know, enough's enough. And they may say, no, you're going to do it. But in turn, the analogy is this. I'll just close with this. It's a long answer to an important question. Minnesota is right now on the Army side is approximately 110% in strength, best in the country. Okay? The brigade that we deployed has troop levels up to about 4,100 soldiers. Minnesota could only deploy 2,600 of them. You're 110%. you know, 10,000 some people. What do you mean you couldn't find the 4,000? What's the problem? The problem was, while we were gathering the 2,600, there was over 1,000 Minnesotans coming back from the Iraq the same time these people were going out the door. Because they were all the onesies and twosies that never got on anyone's big radar screen that had been out there serving the country. That's the Wadenas, that's the Red Wings, that's the Faribles, that's the Mankato Owatonnas and so forth, the Charlie Companies out of Charlie Alpha out of southwest Minnesota, Cloquet. These are all the people that have gone and come back, and they've been pretty low key.
And Madam Chair, I just had one more question. Thank you. For my own edification, you talk about this process of federalizing the Guard. And I was just curious, how does that work? When you get an order federalizing soldiers from the Minnesota Guard, is it just open-ended, or do you get some kind of guidance from the Department of Defense about how long they expect this Title X or federalization to happen? And do you get any lead time when they're going to extend? I'm just wondering, what are sort of the rules of the game? Do you basically just get dictated to an open-ended commitment, or are there parameters to it that can change? How does that all work?
Madam Chair. The answer is kind of. What happens is our staff keep in constant contact with their counterparts at the National Guard Bureau. And they listen to what I refer to as the winds of war. What's happening, what might or might not be occurring. So they kind of periodically say, well, we're hearing this, we're hearing that. So we can say, all right, well, you know, you should be thinking of something other and so forth. But we start doing the analysis. And then we have a unit that is going to be... I got to be careful how I say that. Let's just say they're going to get a oh shucks letter or notice. They've been there before. So we say, hey, time out here. You know, we haven't had that 5-year, 6-year dwell time. You know, what's going on? There's got to be other units in the state. So we start doing our number crunching and so forth. And guess what? That type of unit, there are not that type. And also, since we came back, there's been a turnover of that unit very significantly. So those that were really deployed earlier, most of them either moved to different units or retired or did something else. So less than 20% of the unit really are the ones that were impacted. Because we bring in about 18 to 20% new people each and every year. So there's a, you may say, an employee turnover of every 5 years. So those are the things that we're managing and taking a look at. But it's the unit integrity is a very serious issue because we agree if you can't go with the unit, you will go with the Minnesota. We have had some troops who have gone and volunteered and gone to other states, and the lessons learned is there's nothing like home. The way they're treated and taken care of. So. We are very much aware of your concerns. They are very legitimate, very serious. You're on top of it. And we're fighting it the best way we can. And we think we're going to win because there's a lot of nation attention focusing on doing it right. I mean, let's face it, the election relieved the Secretary of Defense. And so there's a wind of change that are going on, so we think that'll help.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we always... Sorry, I always apologize to the second person who's on the agenda, but we do, if we could kind of finish up the budget thing in 10 minutes, you think you guys can do that? Okay.
Yes.
Good.
Madam Chair, members, to address the other issue is that I ran the family program for the National Guard for 4 years in the early 1990s, right after Operation Desert Storm, and also deployed overseas, so I have that heartfelt need to watch out for the families, so I assure you once again I'll do everything in my power to make sure family issues are resolved and continue to follow up on them. The Governor has approved 4 legislative initiatives for the Department of Military Affairs to consider this legislative session, and I'll go over them real quickly so you can spend more of the time on the budget. The first initiative looks to amend Statute 192-501, which is our incentive program, and it amends it in 2 ways. First of all, what it does is it allows us Currently, we have a reenlistment bonus that soldiers are eligible up to their 12th year of service. What we'd like to do is be able to open up the language on that a little bit so we could give it to people who decide to become officers. What currently exists is that there's a disincentive for young quality soldiers who want to become leaders to become officers because they would lose part of their bonus. By changing the statute, it allows us to give that bonus that they've already earned by their commitment and showing their continued commitment to the National Guard and eliminate that financial disincentive. Also, it helps provide the Adjutant General a little more strategic ability to shape the force, to make sure we have the right people in the right positions to do the job for the state and nation. The second thing is we want to do is we want to be able to offer up to 25 $1,000 scholarships annually to high school seniors. These are people who have either expressed interest or have recently joined the Guard, and to receive the scholarship, they have to actually join the Guard. And this tool allows us to highlight, you know, exceptional young leaders and target them for success in their academic endeavors and in the Guard. So that's the change that we're going to, the first change we want to have. The second change, or the second initiative, is a recreation fund at Camp Ripley, and that deals with providing us an instrument to manage donations, receipt of non-appropriated funds, primarily from the federal level, and a portion of revenues from the recycling programs for the healthy benefit of soldiers and airmen who train at our training sites. And it's in our best interest to provide safe and healthy alternatives to service members that promote their well-being, sense of teammanship, and working together. Examples include biking, boating, team sports equipment, and movies. That's the kind of entertainment things that we're looking at our training sites. The third initiative is remedies a gap that we saw in the support our troops legislation, the support our troops license plate legislation. We found that some service members returning from training, especially if they happen to be injured while they are deployed, they return back to Minnesota and they're not in an active drilling status and they haven't been fully implemented into the VA system. They're kind of in a little bit of a gap. And sometimes they have issues that support the troops money would really help resolve issues on the family side. And by just a relatively minor correction in that legislation, we can get that fixed so we can provide that support to the soldiers and families and the airmen that have that need. And then our fourth legislative initiative changes the classification or the designation of the firefighters serving at Duluth. Currently, the statute does not consider state employees serving the capacity as firefighters as essential employees. If you look at the municipal or county levels, firefighters are considered essential employees, but I think we're the only state agency that carries firefighters, so it wasn't considered in the statute. As these firefighters provide the crash and rescue, not only for the 148 Fighter Wing, but also for the Duluth International Airport, we feel it's important that they be kept on at all times so that flight operations would not be suspended until replacement or other people could be found to take that role. So those are the four legislative initiatives we have for this session as approved by the governor.
Okay. Questions on?
Thank you, ma'am. I'll be followed by Terry Palmer.
Madam Chair, committee members, Terry Palmer. I'm the Comptroller for the Department of Military Affairs. I will be brief. I'll focus on the state's portion of our budget request. The governor is recommending a budget of just over $41 million for the biennium for the Department of Military Affairs. Among three programs, the maintenance of training facilities, the general support program, and the enlistment incentives program. There's also...
Again, members, we apologize for not putting budget books out before you. We'll have that again always in the future. But would you, Mr. Palmer, would you remind people what the proportion of the budget is between federal and state?
Well, in total terms, the federal money coming into the state is about 96% of the total. In terms of the state budget, it's much less than that because a lot of those federal dollars flow directly to soldiers for performing duty, and the federal side does do contracting too. So, in terms of the state budgets, it's significantly less. It's about one-fourth, three-fourths federal money to one-fourth state money. The first program is the maintenance of training facilities. It's the budget that we use to do a number of things, including taking care of the armories that the state owns around the state. That is $11.18 million a year. It also has money in it for That portion of those cooperative agreements we have with the federal government for the operation of the air bases. In the case of Duluth, we have to have provide a 20% match for most of the civil affairs, the civil engineering activities. In the case of Minneapolis, we have to provide 25% match for the federal money. But it's predominantly, that's about a million, just a little over $1 million in federal match money that we have to provide. And then the rest of it is utilities and maintenance and repair of facilities that the state owns. There is a budget initiative. The governor is recommending an appropriation, one-time appropriation of $185,000 to pay special assessments. Minnesota is a little unique in the way we construct our armories. The local communities actually donate the property to the department and participate in the cost of construction of the facility. So we are subject to special assessments, and we don't have money to pay them in our normal budget. So in accordance with state statute, we are requesting that. But this does go back to the local community. It's not money that the agency has use of.
Are the governor's initiatives coming to us as part of the governor's bill, or are they coming to us as separate bills?
Madam Chair, we're not sure at this point. Some of the items are within the budget itself,
okay.
And some are coming in separate bundles, I believe, is what they're going to do. So.
Okay, well, if you've been listening to the Senate, we're looking at some pretty tight deadlines, so I hope we're going to have things here pretty soon.
We hope so too, Madam Chair. There's another budget initiative recommended by the governor. It's $3.5 million over the biennium. Back in 2001, 2002, in order to help balance the state's budget, we laid off 54 custodians at our facilities around the state, assuming that the full-time federal and military guys could maintain the facilities. And as we're finding out, it's not been quite as effective as we'd hoped. Mostly because, in some instances, there's no one back there anymore. They've deployed. But the other issue we have difficulty with is mowing of lawns and plowing of snow and taking care of the boilers, which is one thing they didn't anticipate. So we've had to try to train federal employees to be boiler operators in our facilities, and they have turnover, and it just doesn't work. So this would go a long way to letting the soldiers and the full-time staff concentrate on what they're supposed to be doing, which is making sure they're trained to do the federal and state mission. So we're hoping this one will get funded. The second program we have is the General Supportive Program. It's the Adjutant General staff and the lease in the Veterans Service Building and all of the support activities that go on with those two. And in that case, it's $1.787 million a year, $3.5 million, almost $3.6 million over the biennium. There is a budget initiative in that program, too, and this is something very near and dear to the Adjutant General and something he's worked very closely with the governor on. It's called the Reintegration Program. what they found after Vietnam is they assumed people wanted to be left alone and go about their business, but they also discovered that in doing so, they didn't get a chance to look the soldiers and airmen in the eyes and make sure everything was okay with them and their families. And that's what the intent of this program is, to bring these people in 30, 60, and 90 days at post-deployment, look them in the eye, make sure everything's going okay, provide them counseling, give them some educational materials, pay for some time for suicide prevention training, marriage counseling, all those things that are problematic for people after long periods of being separated from their spouses and loved ones. So that's what the intent of this program is, and we hope that'll get funded too. Within the, there's also an additional budget request for three general support employees within that appropriation. The other issues we've discovered, because of all the deployments, the state has, through the department, the state has quite a bit of state property in the armories that are used by soldiers and airmen. And all of those cooperative agreement dollars that come in are used to support the state activities. So if we purchase property under that cooperative agreement, that property becomes state property, and we're required to track it and make sure that we can account for it and provide that assurance to the Adjutant General and the governor and the federal side that those pieces of property are properly cared for. Currently, it was done up until recently by a one-day-a-week employee at Camp Ripley, and it's impossible to do that task. When units depart from an armory, all of that property should be accounted for and turned over to someone else, and then when they return, there should be a similar activity to turn that property back over to those people coming back to their armory. We just don't have the employees to do that, and one of the full-time employees would be called the state quartermaster to do that. And the other issue we've discovered as these state active duty missions get more and more complicated, we don't have the state staff on hand to do that pre-planning for the emergencies. So now what happens is until the governor declares an emergency, we can't bring people on to do any of the planning or ramping up for any of the missions. And it becomes very problematic when you start to deal with avian flu and with the Republican National Convention and all those things, because we have to do a considerable amount of planning. And it's things we haven't done in the past. If you're talking about fighting fires or preparing for floods, if it's a minor activity, it's fairly easy to mobilize and get people ready. But if it's a larger activity or something we haven't dealt with in the past, we're not doing justice to our state military members and having them report for duty when we're not really sure what the missions are and how we will react to those. So that's another initiative in the general support program for three additional employees. And that's $275,000 the first year and $285,000 in the second year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, I like the idea of the additional money for the armories. I spoke with Colonel Ulmus. I have Cottage Grove, and there's an armory in there, so that's a good thing. My question, though, is to the reintegration one-time money. My understanding of the program is that it is going to be ongoing, and it's going to be available for everyone, no matter when they arrive back, continuing for the families and the military men and women. How come it's one-time money? Maybe a little history.
This is what the governor's recommended. It's one-time money, but it's available till expended. So for at least the 2 years of the biennium, that money is available for any returnees that may be coming back during that period. And I suspect if the tempo of the war continues on and we have more members coming back, we'll ask the governor for similar authority in out years too. But and then our largest program is the Enlistment Incentives Program. It's the money that the legislature actually provides to the service members, the Minnesota National Guard, Army and Air members, to help them decide to join the military and to continue their membership in the military. It's been an extremely successful program. There were a couple of changes made last biennium. One had to do with the extension of the benefits to members who chose to not re-enlist, so they're leaving the service, but they get to use the program for the period of time they spent on active duty plus 2 years, which has been a welcome addition to the program. And the other piece was the re-enlistment bonus of $1,000 up to a maximum of $5,000 for a five-year re-enlistment. And as you heard, the general, the state of Minnesota has been extremely successful in recruiting young men and women, and certainly in a large part has to do with the willingness to serve as Minnesotans, but we like to think it's because of the generosity of the legislature and the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota that those programs that we have, the enlistment incentives programs, also provide some incentive for those members to join and to remain members of the Minnesota Guard. So we've been very appreciative of those programs, and they're extremely successful in helping us accomplish that mission. And then the final piece that you'll see in our budget is the emergency services. There is no appropriation from the budget for that program, but it is an open appropriation, and it does show up in the state budget's books. When the governor declares an emergency, he requests funding from the legislature for those activities, and that pays for those responses to the floods and the fires and all those other activities. So. And then there's also a budget page on the salary adjustment. The governor's recommending a 2% increase in state salaries to help pay for the expected increases in salary costs over the next 2 years. And that's basically our presentation, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you very much for coming. I'm sure we'll probably have some more questions. And nice to know we can get them from you at any time. Okay.
We're
thanks.
Thank you, Madam. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. We now have the campaign finance board.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Jean Olson. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. With me today is Jeff Sigurdson, who is the Assistant Director at the board. Do you want the brief overview of the board in this activity? So, okay. The Campaign Finance Board is a six-member board. All members are appointed by the governor and must be confirmed by a 3/5 majority of both the House and Senate acting separately. We're the only board that does need the House confirmation. At least two members of the board must be former members of the legislature, one from each party. Currently holding those positions are Bob Milbert from the Democratic Party and Hilda Betterman from the Republican Party. No more than three members may be of the same political party, and it takes a concurring vote of four to decide any issue before the board. We currently have three Republicans, two Democrats, and one member with no political affiliation. The board is bipartisan or tripartisan, and the staff is of nine is always nonpartisan. We're a disclosure agency. We receive filings for multiple programs and make them available to the public in a variety of ways. Our office is open. People can come in and see any of the filed documents. They don't have to tell us whose reports they're looking at or why they're in there. They can also use a public use computer that's available in the office, and we have many items on our website that's available for searching. In the last year, the board and its staff have begun to scan all the documents, the campaign finance report, lobbyist reports, economic interest statements. All of those things are then available on the board, the board's website, so people from around the state can see them. There was always a disadvantage to people living in outstate to be able to get copies of campaign finance reports, and this makes it a whole lot easier for them. We have noticed a drastic decrease in the number of folks coming to our office. They don't have to come to our office anymore to see the reports. They can just go online. In the campaign finance program in the last year, we had over 850 registered candidate committees. Of that, about 475 filed for office. The other ones are people that either didn't win in the, didn't get endorsement or haven't yet terminated from the last time they ran for office. We have 350 political party units and 350 political committees and funds registered with the board. In 2006, we paid $4.8 million out in public subsidies to legislative and constitutional office candidates and about $100,000 to the four political parties, the DFL, the Republican, the Independence Party, and the Green Party. The payments to the party are 5% of the party checkoff that tax filers make. The public subsidy is also based on checkoff money and an additional $1.25 million general fund appropriation to the general account. Of that amount, $130,000 each biennium is appropriated to the Office of Administrative Hearings to offset their costs in dealing with complaints about the Fair Campaign, about 10A candidates under the Fair Campaign Practices Act, and I'll say more about that later. House candidates this year were paid on a two-year tax checkoff, and the Senate and the constitutional offices were paid based on four-year checkoff. In addition to the direct payments, we assume that in calendar year 2006, another $4.5 million will be refunded through the Political Contribution Refund Program. The state has been generous with its candidates, and that refund program is... well, you know that better than I do, loved by the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Public subsidy payments and the funds for the political contribution refunds are direct appropriations from the state general fund. public subsidy payments dollars are appropriated to the board for only that purpose, and the PCR refunds are paid out through the Department of Revenue. About 6 or 8 years ago, the legislature funded the board to create some software. We have done that. Since the initial creation of it, the board has been able to upgrade and maintain it with current staff. About half of the candidates who filed for office in 2006 did file their campaign finance report using the board software. Many more entities, candidates, political committees, and political funds are using the software, but they're printing out a copy and mailing it in. We can tell that because it's got a specific look. We wish they would file electronically. It would decrease staff data entry time, but they choose not to for whatever reason. Software assists them with statutory compliance. It warns them about limits, about inappropriate contributions, about contributions from lobbyists. And people that use the software and do checks every 30 or 45 days, we find, don't violate any of the provisions, any of the compliance provisions. Candidate use of the software has doubled in recent years, although, as I just got done saying, we wish it was even better. The board is also the filing agency for the statements of economic interest. As you remember, when you filed for office, you all had to file the statement of economic interest within 14 days after you filed for office. In addition to legislative and constitutional officers, there's about, and some legislative staff, there's about 1,000 other defined public officials in the state of Minnesota. They would be the commissioners, assistant commissioners, deputy commissioners, agency heads, assistant agency heads, board members. They all, too, file economic interest statements. The statements need to be updated by March or April 15th of this year if there are changes. We'll send you out a form that has your current information on it. If that information is correct, you don't have to return it. If there are changes, however, you need to make the changes and get them back to us. For new members of the legislature, there will be changes because you'll want to add the state of Minnesota as a source of income. And so you'll probably have to get them back into us. Lobbyist program, we also register and are the filing office for the reports by the lobbyists. Lobbyists report twice a year. We have about 1,250 registered lobbyists. Staff has, through its own efforts, not any additional appropriation, provided online reporting for lobbyists and their principals. The lobbyist reporting option online is used by over 90% of the lobbyists. Granted, lobbyist reporting is a whole lot easier than campaign finance reporting, so we understand why that is, but we sure wish we had 90% in the campaign finance, too. These 1,250 lobbyists register and report on behalf of 1,150 associations. The associations have to file once a year on March 15th, and they, almost 100% of them, file online. It's just, as you remember, one number rounded to the nearest $20,000 in what they spend in Minnesota in lobbying in a calendar year. The board is also the agency that administers the ban on gifts from lobbyists and their principals to public officials. First passed in 1994. Looking around the table, there's a few people that were here in 94. The requests for advisory opinions concerning that have decreased greatly in the last few years. We think that people understand it now and are abiding by it. The ban applies to all public officials, including legislators, commissioners, the folks I mentioned earlier. And in addition, it covers legislative staff. It's the only part of our statute that we oversee any of the activities of legislative staff. So our website, we like our website. We get a lot of hits on it. It includes candidates, their principal campaign committee information, treasurers, chairs, websites if you give them to us, your email if you give them to us, whether or not candidates have a valid public subsidy agreement. You can view your economic interest statements online, and now the report of receipts and expenditures. Although the report of receipts and all of these things are just a static file, at this point the reports of receipts and expenditures aren't searchable. You just have to look at the flat data, which is very helpful in itself. Also on the list, on our website, is the list of lobbyists and their principals, who candidates need to know who a lobbyist is, because they have to know that for the gift ban. for the prohibition on contributions from lobbyists during the session and the aggregate contribution limit. Lobbyists are supposed to provide to candidates, at the time they give a contribution, their lobbyist registration number. We have found many lobbyists this year that haven't done that and have inadvertently put candidates over the aggregate limit. If the candidate doesn't know an individual as a lobbyist, it's hard for them to know to add that amount of money into their aggregate contribution limit. The board has in the past year fined several lobbyists for not providing their registration number. It's a fine up to $1,000, is it, Jeff, for failure to provide their registration number. It's not so hard on the lobbyists. It's really hard on the candidates if they don't know that someone's a lobbyist. So staff thinks we're doing a better job on making sure that those lobbyists do provide that registration number. We have the list of political committees and funds. Again, you need to know that for the aggregate contribution limit. And you also have to know to ensure that whoever you're getting your money from is registered with the board. If it's not an individual, their name has to be on this list. And in the past few years, since people are using our website more, we have fewer people taking from unregistered associations, but we're not 100% yet. And so we hope people will visit our website a little more to make sure that they don't take from inappropriate sources, that they stay within the aggregate contribution limits, and they don't take during the legislative session from lobbyists or PACs. We also have on our website the list of party units. Party units is a different aggregate limit, as you know, and so you need to know. Some party units sound like they might be PACs, and some PACs sound like they might be party units. You have to know which is which, so you know which pot of money to put that contribution. We have on the website our list of the board's advisory opinions. I think we go back to opinions starting with number 100 or something. We don't have 100% of them out there because the law has changed and we don't want to confuse people. But for the advisory opinions that are out there, they're searchable by topic and by keywords. And so if you have a question that you wonder what the board has said in the past about that, you can go take a look at our advisory opinions. The website also includes board members and their bios, not their contact information on the web, but staff and all of our contact information is available on the web. We have listservs that people can sign up for and get automatic emails about campaign finance or the software or just general board information or lobbying information. So if you folks aren't on our listserv and you want to do that, you can go to our website and just pick out which of the things you want to be automatically notified about. So that's a general overview. I'll talk briefly about the budget, and then Jeff and I are here for questions. The governor's recommendations, as you heard earlier, include a 2% increase in both in personnel costs. That's going to be very helpful for the board with the increase to health care. Senior moment. Anyway, and the governor is also recommending 2% increase in our rent, and that's very helpful to us. When you add rent and salaries and fringe benefits together, it's over 90% of our budget. So when we don't get funded for that, there's no place. It's only 10% of our budget to take stuff out of. So we're very appreciative that we got the increase in both personnel costs and in the rent. The governor also, in the budget documents, recommends that the board's financial and HR activities be taken care of through the SMART proposal. I believe that was the governor recommended that because he thought that we were asking for a funding increase for more personnel. We weren't. We were funded for the number of personnel we have. We're doing okay with that. And I believe that the governor thought that they were helping us by transferring some of our functions someplace else. We currently have enough funds to pay people to do that ourselves. Once in a while, we have an extraordinary event that we do need help from the Department of Finance or the Department of Employee Relations. They have excellent people up in those departments that are quick to assist us. And mainly, we think because of the political nature of what we do, we should keep all of our activities within our little house. So I believe that that's optional thing for us to go into, but we don't want to be mandated into it.
Is that something that you've asked the governor for? We're going to get, at some point, we'll get change orders from the governor on the budget. Is that anything that you've asked to have a change order? Do we need to have a change order on that?
It's my understanding that you don't need a changeover because the governor is, is what the governor is asking for an increased appropriation of, you know, $250,000 or something to fund this SMART group. So it's not going to impact our budget. We're not going to have to pay for anything, but we don't want our activities over there. We want to keep them. And if, as long as it's optional, it's not a problem. And I will follow legislation. I will let you know if it becomes not optional. Last year, the legislature reduced the non-checked-off dollar, the general appropriation, from $1.5 million to $1.25 million. And of that $1.25 million, as I said earlier, $130,000 of that comes out each year to the Office of Administrative Hearings. The legislature may wish to restore those cuts. You may wish to put the money that's been in there since 1994 back to where it has. I understand that has budgetary consequences, but last year, in the last biennium, the Office of Administrative Hearings used a small portion, less than half of what was appropriated to them. But if you look at their website this year, there have been many, many, many complaints about Chapter 10A candidates, and we're certain that they're probably going to use up the whole 130 and then and more than that. So that's basically it. It's what we do, and we're happy with the budget. And the only problem would be that if we were mandated to be into the SMART program.
Madam Chair, have you had a chance to analyze the campaign risk reports that were last week at all?
Madam Chair and Representative Speakum, some of them, we haven't got them all data entered yet, though, and until we get them all data entered.
A simple question.
Okay.
I doubt you maybe have a chance to do this yet, but have you been able to, from the standpoint of independent expenditures, can you tell me who the top five independent expenditures were in the state?
Madam Chair and Representative Spigum, no, I can guess. I could guess that, you know, Education Minnesota. Well, maybe Jeff knows. Do you know the answer to that? No. Do you want me to get that information for you, Representative Spigum? Okay. Again, we don't have all of the reports entered, and until we get all the reports entered, we won't know who. But I can give you who were the high five in of course, that doesn't help because all the independent expenditures come out late.
My second question, Madam Chair, you run a wonderful office here, and you know, I respect you work a lot. What's your biggest headache? What can we do to relieve that headache, and would it cause you any problem with either transparency of election spending or campaign spending or ethics reform? Do you have a headache out there that we can relieve you of that really doesn't serve the public well at all as far as...
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Speakum, what a nice offer.
I suppose
the biggest headache we do have is the data entry of the campaign finance reports. Now, I'm not suggesting you want to mandate. I don't know if you file electronically, but I would hesitate suggesting that you mandate electronic filing. I think there's a learning curve on our software, and for some smaller entities who maybe only spend $5,000 or $10,000, you'd hate to have them spend a quarter of it on a computer to have to report. Nationally, what we're seeing is the trend in requiring candidates to file over the Internet so that you wouldn't be using our software. You just go to a secure Internet site, file your campaign finance reports there, and it's all immediately searchable. And we're also seeing nationally that they're requiring that to be done every month or every two months, 3 months. Somebody has to sit down and fill out the reports. Again, I'm not suggesting you do that. I'm not even sure it's necessary, especially in non-election years. There's just not enough activity going on. But most staff time is spent on data entry.
I heard a complaint, of course, now then, this admits that I'm one of the campaigns that you don't like, but my campaign treasurer has complained about the difficulty of getting, allowed to fax them in to you, but you can never get into your fax on that last day. And the,
you know,
question of why, you know, why can't the faxes go overnight and why can't that?
Madam Chair, we do have a fax. We do have an overload fax. You know, we have the one fax line and then we have an overload fax. But the one fax is incoming, and we have an incoming 800 number on that fax line too. We have thought about getting, you know, a third fax, but for three reporting periods, four reporting periods for campaign finance in a two-year period and lobbyist reporting, because we hear the same argument from lobbyists, that the fax is busy, it's busy, it's busy. I don't know that the price trade-off is there to buy a fax for six filing times a year. But yes, that
what
is
about letting it just run?
It does. Madam Chair, it does. It runs all night long.
It does,
we come
run
in
all
and there's faxes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it does run all, or if it's, you know, out of paper or something, it stores it and then prints it out the minute we get in.
Okay.
So
that's
true. That's true. Okay. Oh, good. I'm not lying then.
I don't know if that's just something we didn't know or
we are the Department of Administration has been working with us, and they're going to redo the hallway out in front. If anybody's been to our office, they know how dark and dingy that hallway is out there. So they're going to be doing the hallway out there. And because we're having fewer people in our office making copies of campaign finance reports, because they can get them right off the Internet, we are thinking and talking about what we're going to do. We've got that second copying machine, and maybe what you're pointing out is we don't need a second copying machine, we need a second fax machine, because nobody uses the second copying machine anyway. But we'll think about that, Representative.
Madam Chair, thank you, Ms. Olson. I just had a question from a number of folks within my district this last year on PCRs.
Yeah.
And when they would call in to check on PCRs, they were told that it had to be, you know, if there's a certain number of days before that the campaign finance board would release some information on that, on their PCRs. Tell me what, I'm assuming maybe it's a staffing situation, but can you tell me why they cannot get immediate response on questions of PCRs?
Well, no, Madam Chair and Representative Ward, depending on what their question is, if it's I don't have I haven't got my refund, we have no control over that. That's out of the Department of Revenue, and the only number that the Department of Revenue gives us to give to them is a general number that they call in, and they have to punch a bunch of numbers. But I think what you're talking about is something that happened right at the end of the year, and do you remember what that was with the at the end of a year when you legislators, all your public subsidy agreements went out of effect December 31st. So revenue wanted that final tally, who was entitled to get refunds. And then at the beginning of the year, we didn't get who had re-signed them to the Department of Revenue immediately, because the Department of Revenue told us they were not going to start refunding 2007 contributions until they had refunded all the 2006 contributions. So they didn't want they didn't want to mix their data. Am I saying that correctly? I'm not a technical person, but I think that's what happened there. So folks that had given a contribution and wanted it right back in 2007, it just isn't going to happen.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, members. Okay. Meeting adjourned.